You go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving the green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
And now we have a king. I'm not an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a deed? How come you can buy our house with our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
They have every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of soup looking in the mirror at itself.
Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
Welcome, welcome. This is the Three Left Show. All right, this is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, coming to you live. This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. What's the vision, anyway? A left that is of itself and for itself. The meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology, so get those Biden memes out of here. Those are the three lefts, and so this show is for going in a different direction. Because three lefts make a right, and so on and so on. So this episode, as per usual, I will string a bunch of thoughts together and hopefully not over-explain everything. This will be part four of the pandemic response, so to speak, or at least the discussion on my end. New normals, call it something like that, or this isn't the normal I was expecting. This isn't the new normal I wanted. So first, let's just go into it. Let's see. What should I start with first? Let's start with the MIT Tech Review. So this is from the technocratic side of looking at things. Though at the end, they will tease, like, you know, the usual kind of liberal, you know, inequality seems to be a problem. I have no idea how to do anything about it. I'm a science nerd, not a social science nerd, okay? Soft sciences, get out. This one's called We're Not Going Back to Normal. Social distancing is here to stay for much more than a few weeks. It will upend our way of life in some ways forever. Now, point of fact, most of the stories I'm reading today have been filed in the last 2 months. So things, of course, the situation is always changing and the type of information being put out. Some of it's conflicting. For example, there's all the stories of, rather reports of things in the world. The kind of the shocks and the amount of devastation, how it's hitting certain communities that are vulnerable because of lack of health care and injustice, a lack of justice. But then there'll be, like, say, a story about how people who tested positive reinfected, you know, how the testing needs to be basically on a weekly basis, very frequent, if not daily basis. There's not enough testing to do that. Certain, say, here in New York, the governor has put out, you know, stipulations on, like, if you're a business, what do you have to do to reopen? Well, you basically need to be a big corporate business because it's like you need to test your employees regularly. And if you're a small business or medium even, you're not going to be able to afford that. It's all going to be gone. It's all centralizing. I'll get to that more as we read. To stop coronavirus, we need to radically change almost everything we do. Now, technocrats will say, you know, radical change is coming, but what kind of radical change are they talking about? Not the kind I envision, not the kind I would fight for and do fight for in my off time. But that's what kind of demotivates me right now is that I'm not really currently able to, unless it's in virtual space, which as far as the radical change I'm looking for, which is to localize and decentralize, that means not doing things virtually. That means doing things in my neighborhood, in my city, in my, maybe my state, but that still requires some things. So region, thinking regionally, bioregionally. So anyway, likely change everything in our daily day life, which, you know, has its problems, issues, exercise, socializing, shopping, managing our health, you know, all the things that a lot of us are even able to do. We all want things to go back to normal quickly. Okay, again, who's we? But what most of us have probably not yet realized, yet will soon, is that things won't go back to normal after a few weeks or even a few months. Some things never will. It's now widely agreed, even by Britain finally, that every country needs to flatten the curve, impose social distancing, slow the spread of the virus, so that the number of people sick at once doesn't cause the healthcare system to collapse, mostly because it's been underfunded all these decades. As it is threatening to do so in Italy right now, and this is back in March, that means the pandemic needs to last at a low level. That's a weird phrasing. Maybe that's a typo. That means the pandemic needs to last, perhaps meaning the state of the pandemic, or at least we're thinking about the pandemic is happening. But, you know, if you read it flatly, it's like this pandemic needs to keep going. It needs to go on as long as possible. More people need to die. You know, what does that mean, right? But I want to stipulate from the get-go, this is not like, I haven't even read any or looked at any plandemic memes or whatever. That's not my bag. This is not how, don't frame anything I read or say in that sense, okay? You're thinking, we want to think class, we want to think structures, infrastructures, you know, how things work, how things have worked thus far in our society, and why certain things fail, or why the transformation that is occurring is a certain way. Especially if you talk about community and interactions. That's the power of ecology to that there's, you know, the collective unconsciousness, or the zeitgeist as it's called, is the complete totality of all the interactions that we, you know, that everything has. How long would that take? How draconian do social restrictions need to be? Yesterday, the president announcing new guidelines, such as a 10-person limit on gatherings, that's real old news, isn't it? Said that with several weeks of focused actions, you know, skip that. But it won't end there. As long as someone in the world has the virus, breakouts can and will keep recurring without stringent controls to contain them. Much like, say, smallpox or something like that. In a report yesterday, researchers at Imperial College London proposed a way of doing this. Impose more extreme social distancing measures every time admissions to intensive care units start to spike, and relax them each time admissions fall. Here's what it looks like in a graph. So basically, it's one large spike for 2 months, and then as it dips, we relax social distancing, as we're probably going to be doing anyway, just as a matter of living. Then it spikes a little bit again, but basically a quarter of the amount, and then that occurs every... It's basically a 2 months on, 1 month off kind of situation. The orange line is ICU admissions. Each time they rise above a threshold, let's say 100 per week, the country, so 100 in the U.S., I mean, shouldn't it be? Anyway, the country would close all schools, and most universities adopt social distancing. When they drop below 50, those measures would be lifted, but people with symptoms or those family members have symptoms would be confined at home. So one of those conflicting stories was one about a meatpacking plant where they tested everyone there, finally. And let's see, it was 300 tested positive, but out of those 300, 90% were asymptomatic. Now, if we actually do mass testing, but this is weird because the data coming out of, say, the Asian countries and the countries that have already kind of gone over their hump, they've done mass testing. And have they put out numbers as to what percentage are asymptomatic but have tested positive? If it's so high, then is this, like someone was asking, and maybe it was probably a not quite informed question, was is this really a pandemic if the fatality rate based on the amount of people who actually contract it but don't actually show symptoms? Is it actually like a normal flu? Is it like a normal cold where... And enough people, those with complications, get influenza, get pneumonia, and succumb. But the rate probably is more than those things. But that's why that kind of data of the mass testing is kind of important to understand what exactly is going on, how bad is it. And until then, we're taking a safety first approach, which is interesting because... When it comes to, say, anything, like presidential candidate Jill Stein kind of put it when it came to things like mass wireless, and I'm not subscribing to any conservative ideas about what 5G does, but certainly there is an untested effect of putting all of different kinds of wavelengths around us. Certainly it must have, well, okay, we don't know what kind of effect it does, and that's the thing. So in science, you would take a precautionary principle. You need to fully understand something before you implement it. Understand what effects it will have, what relationship it will have to other things. Right? Does it cause some kind of effect or does it not? Or is it marginal? If we actually put the precautionary principle in effect in our society, it leads to these drastic shocks because our system is not precautionary at all. You know, an industry, you start using a chemical because it has some kind of function. And if, say, in the 50 years that it uses it, it poisons a million people and water supplies, well, oh, oopsie doopsie. I guess we'll cover that up and make sure people can't sue us and all the others, you know, Aaron Brockovich kind of plots. But they weren't being precautionary about it. Like, if we use this chemical, will it cause cancers in a million people? That wasn't followed. But that wasn't followed because of profit making, and that is how our industry functions. If it actually is regulated, or at least there's a culture of being better safe than sorry, what kind of progress, quote unquote progress, will we have? Of course, we would have a lot less cancer too. Under this model, the researchers conclude social distancing, and school closures would need to be in force some 2/3 of the time, roughly 2 months on, 1 month off, until a vaccine is available. So that's why vaccine development is key to kind of maybe stifling what this new normal would be, which will take at least 18 months, if it works at all. They note that the results are quantitatively similar for the U.S. 18 months, surely there must be other solutions. Why not just build more ICUs and treat more people at once, for example? You know, raise the line. Well, in the researchers' model, that didn't solve the problem. Without social distancing of the whole population, they found even the best mitigation strategy, which means isolation or quarantine of the sick, the old, and those who have been exposed, plus school closures, would still lead to a surge of critically ill people 8 times bigger than the U.S. or the U.K. system can cope with. That's the lowest blue curve in the graph. This is the second graph that they have. Links will be posted in show notes on 3lefts.news. How about imposing restrictions for just one batch of 5 months or so? No good. Once measures are lifted, the pandemic breaks out all over again. Only this time it's in winter, the worst time for overstretched healthcare systems. And of course, then you have to ask, why is it so overstretched? Germany has a better fatality rate because they have extra hospitals. They overbuilt. They have surplus. But what if we decide to be brutal, set the threshold number of ICU admissions for triggering social distancing much higher, accepting that many more patients would die? Turns out it makes a little difference. Even in the least restrictive of the Imperial College scenarios, we're shut in more than half the time. This isn't a temporary disruption. It's the start of a completely different way of life. Living in a state of pandemic, in the short term, this will be hugely damaging to businesses that rely on people coming together in large numbers. Gives a fairly long list. I'm sure you can imagine them all now. That's to say nothing of the stresses on parents thrust into homeschooling their kids. Maybe they should collectivize that and start free schools. You know, I actually encountered a batch of homeschoolers, but they weren't, at least that I'm not aware of, what the motives for the homeschooling was. Sometimes it's a very left-leaning set of values that lead to it, like, schools are authoritarian. It's too structured. It is like a prison. These are all true statements. So I can understand why a parent would want to homeschool. But it wasn't just one parent, one kid. A bunch of homeschools created a little network and a kind of a club of sorts where they basically take turns being the teacher. So they're only really doing the homeschooling 1 day a week. And then the student, you know, the kids being homeschooled, they basically form a class because there is 8 of them, which is, you know, good studio sized class. And they did projects and they worked together more or less. I don't know if they traveled to a common place to do it or each other's homes. Maybe they just came together to do trips together. But I found it an interesting idea. What if this was done on a mass scale where, let's say, again, in a future where we have a 3-day work week, let's say, then everyone has the ability to be a teacher one day a week. But then you're deprofessionalizing teaching, but you're also making the classes so much smaller that I think you can manage, 5 kids who actually want to do something and are not being forced. So then discipline and other things don't really have to factor in except follow the adult. And that means the adult needs to be worth following. Tangent over. There will be some adaptation. Of course, gyms could start selling home equipment, online training, consumer stuff. We're seeing an explosion of new services in what's already been dubbed the shut-in economy. Never calling it that. One can also wax hopeful about, of course, the shut-in economy are for those who can pay for it. One can also wax hopeful about the way some habits might change. Less carbon-burning travel, more local supply chains, more walking and biking, I guess. Yes, the number of bikes that have been sold in my area has gone up. There was a story about that. Not a massive spike, but, we sold 10 more bikes in the last month. That's quite a bit more than usual. Maybe this is more in suburban areas, though. But, it's for leisure. It's not for getting... it's more about getting out. But, hey, that's good. Because without all the other commercialized entertainment, everyone's turning to nature. It's interesting. It's good. Fascinating. So how can we live in this new world? Part of the answer, hopefully, will be better healthcare systems. Again, hopefully. With pandemic response units, we're not going to act politically, or suggest anything political. But, this is all just kind of nebulous, it'll figure it out on its own. With pandemic response units that can move quickly to identify and contain outbreaks before they start the spread. But otherwise, these are suggestions for counties and state governments to implement. And the ability to quickly ramp up production of medical equipment, in a planned way. What does that imply? In the next term, we'll probably find awkward compromises that allow us to retain some semblance of a social life. Maybe movie theaters will take out half their seats. Meetings will be held in larger rooms with spaced out chairs. And gyms will require you to book workouts ahead of time so they don't get crowded. I don't think that's actually doable because when I look at, say, how mixed up the experts have been about, what the science is when it comes to studying pandemics, but what we would say is that actually we need to be 13 feet apart, not 6, to really actually be safe, if we don't have masks on. Otherwise, I guess the 6 feet rule and everybody's always wearing masks, right? But of course, the masks need to be, cleaned every week. Though I guess there'll be mask cleaning services. That way we don't have to rely on disposable masks. That'll create a whole new set of litter and garbage or pre-garbage. Ultimately, I predict that we'll restore the ability to socialize safety by developing more sophisticated ways to identify who is a disease risk and who isn't, and discriminating legally against those who are. Now, this is rather insidious. Legal discrimination based on disease risk. Now, I have not fully read Foucault, a postmodern philosopher, but he wrote extensively about social control. And my roommate... nameless, has Foucault books on his shelf. And of course, as soon as the pandemic kind of started, he started busting them out and start quoting them at me, the unseen enemy. And it's a basically authoritarian's dream to be able to police everyone. And of course you can see it in New York City, the people being arrested for not wearing masks or being, in groups, are black and brown. There weren't many, there was 10. But the 10 arrests made, one was light-skinned. Take that as you likely would. We can see harbingers of this in the measures some countries are taking today. Israel is going to use cell phone location data, which its intelligence services track terrorists to trace people who've been in touch with known carriers of the virus. So there you see the big there would be a big overlap in the rhetoric. It's all for our safety. This is just like the war on terror. I'm not saying it's just like it because, unlike terrorism, the actual death rate is real and affects the marginalized and the vulnerable. Unlike terrorism, which, if done properly, would affect the people higher up the pyramid, social pyramid. And that's why billions and billions can be, and trillions even, can be spent fighting terrorism. But paying for mass is something that's left to the marketplace. But when it comes to the enforcement of getting things back to business, meaning big business, getting back to normal, then all the stops will be pulled. I'm stunned by the depth of coronavirus information being released in Singapore. On this website, you can see every known infection case. So this is the use of tech to track everything. Where the person lives and works, which hospital they got admitted to, and the tech network topology of carriers. Now, see, it's like this is smart grid stuff. This is smart cities, smart tech. But how it's used, you know, okay, now we're going to like expand the police state once again. But now it's for fighting the invisible enemy. Hell, these terrorists can show up on TV. We don't know exactly what this new future looks like, of course, but one can imagine a world in which to get a flight, perhaps you'll have to be signed up to a service that tracks your movements via your phone. The airline wouldn't be able to see where you'd gone. How's that different than now? But it would get an alert if you've been close to known infected people, use these hotspots. Again, can't trust people. Why not just provide this information on the fly to anyone who is traveling so they can avoid hotspots and whatnot? There would be temperature scanners everywhere and your workplace might demand. Now, of course, China could roll all this stuff out in a matter of weeks. We're talking about like years, or at least by the end of the year. This is like things that might be rolled out. Might be. I'm not confident in that. Again, we couldn't even distribute masks properly. Now we're just finally starting to. But again, it's so scattershot. Like there was a conversation on Facebook, and it was, Rite Aid Pharmacy, corporate pharmacy, was giving away 2 free masks with every purchase. That's okay. But it kind of needs to be like the city needs to send 5 masks, a pack of masks, to every resident. Cities never done something so universal. Cities and Americans are not used to that. We're not used to universal anything. But of course, the disease affects us universally. And that is the big difference, right? This isn't just a natural disaster that affects one city or one part of the country. And the rest of the country can just kind of not care. It's everywhere. And it affects everyone. Except for those who are asymptomatic. I guess they can carry on. But not quite. We'll adapt to and accept such measures much as we've adapted to increasingly stringent airport security. Even though all of that was theater. In the wake of terrorist attacks. The intrusive surveillance will be considered a small price to pay for the basic freedom to be with other people. Small price to pay. This intrusive surveillance. I don't consider it a small price to pay. Who the hell is saying it's small? These tech bros are. These technocrats consider it a small price to pay because they're not the ones that are ever going to be approached by the police. Their lives are already isolated and alienated. Moreover, unless there are strict rules on how someone's risk for disease is assessed, governments or companies could choose any criteria. You're high risk if you earn less than 50 grand a year, or a family of more than 6 people and live in certain parts of the country. For example, that creates a scope of math-based bias and hidden discrimination. It's not really hidden, though, if you're actually being quite overt about it. This happened last year when an algorithm used by health insurers were turned out to inadequately favor white people. The world has changed many times and is changing again. All of us will have to adapt to a new way of living, working, and forging relationships. But as with all change, there will be some who lose more than most. And they will be the ones who have lost far too much already. Well, at least they're humane enough to admit that, right? The best we can hope for, because hope is all these people have, for is that the depth of this crisis to finally force countries, the U.S. in particular, to fix the yawning, meaning growing, social inequities that make large swaths of their population so immensely, intensely vulnerable. Don't count on that without revolts of some kind. It's not happening by its own. They're not like wising up. They're acting the same as ever. You know, revenues drop. They start, all of our officials talk of austerity. Just like 12 years ago. Same exact response. Are we going to tax the rich now? No, we're going to cut more. And since we can't cut police and fire, we'll be cutting health care. We'll be cutting education. And what do you know? Billionaire Bill Gates strolls in with his health care, with his education agenda. It really frustrates me the way people stand for him. Not just, look, it looks like it's, oh, he's doing good. He saved lives with his philanthropy. Okay, fine. All the other structural and philanthropy is just a grift stuff aside. And this is how capitalists retain power over everything. Consider Bill Gates' education agenda, which is to computerize everything, mass testing and standardized testing, and basically, you know, depersonalize and create basically a dystopian kind of education system. He just proposed with in New York with Cuomo. Cuomo and him did a, I don't know if it was a press conference or whatnot, but they were proposing like with as long as the schools are closed, we should have this systematic, fully, you know, digital, and we should like, this will be the new education system. They proposed it as a, it's a revolution in education. Finishing what, you know, this, what he started. The man who didn't go to college, who actually doesn't like schools in the first place, but also loves the idea of selling computers. But that was MIT Press, MIT Tech Review. The other status quo story before I get to the opposite. So this is from Bloomberg Opinion, as usual, the opinion side, because they're, get ready, a bigger disruption is coming. The COVID-19 pandemic reflects a systemic crisis akin to the seminal crashes of the 20th century. This is by Panjak Mishra. Again, this is from mid-March, so this is in the early times of the lockdown. This is the first of a two-part series, it says. As the global supply chains break, airlines slash flights, borders rise within nation states, stock exchanges convulse with fear, and recession looms over economies from China to Germany. We can no longer doubt that we are living through extraordinary times. Of course we were. What remains in question, however, is our ability to comprehend them while using a vocabulary derived from decades when globalization seemed a fact of nature. Again, this is from a rich person's point of view, or at least someone who works for rich people. Globalization is a fact of life. It's almost natural, like the air and wind. For the coronavirus signals a radical transformation of a kind that occurs once in a century, shattering previous assumptions. And it is usually some kind of natural, but also man-made, you know, related disaster. Or at least man-made causes make it worse. In fact, the last such churning occurred, churning's a weird word to use there, occurred almost exactly a century ago, and it altered the world so dramatically that a revolution in the arts, sciences, and philosophy, not to mention the discipline of economics, was needed to even make sense of it, referring to the First World War. The opening years of the 20th century, too, were defined by a free global market for goods, capital, and labor. This was when John Keynes reminisced, the inhabitant of London could order by telephone, sipping his morning tea in bed, the various products of the whole earth. But this is only if you lived in London. This maker as well, because everything was kind of flowing one way. This maker as well as consumer of global capitalism could invest his wealth in the natural resources and new enterprises in any quarter of the world. He could also secure forthwith, as he wished, a cheap and comfortable means of transit to any country or climate without passport or other formality. Such are the privileges of imperialism. Such an economically enmeshed world seemed to many the perfect insurance against war. A contemporary version of such optimism was Thomas Friedman's Golden Arches theory, according to which no two countries with two McDonald's would go to war. Totally naive in retrospect. But, of course, if you ask any actual left-leaning person, they could say, no, there's quite a lot more going on in the world. For example, you're kind of, if you just focus on the line in London, you're kind of ignoring all the ways that that empire functioned through violence, through war and such. And thus, the First World War can be viewed as a German revolt against British power. Britain had a pretty much imperial monopoly on most of the world at that time. And other countries wanted to at least, they wanted some equity in that. They wanted to take part. They didn't want to be indebted to British bankers, as most were. And if you're going to, if you have to force the issue, you got to fight a war. The First World War was not only brought the period of friction-free globalization to a gruesome end. Of course, there was no, of course, there was friction everywhere. There was friction against all of the indigenous people. There was friction against other nation states, like in other empires, like China and the Ottomans. Friction-free, my ass. But that, such is the viewpoint of this ahistorical, right? He's looking to history, but he's also being completely ahistorical about it by ignoring actually what happened. But I'll continue. It also cruelly exposed an intelligentsia, the First World War, which had believed in irreversible progress, and now was forced to acknowledge that, as an embittered Henry James wrote to a friend in August 1914, the tide that bore us along was then all the while moving to this grand Niagara. As with our own crisis, the seminal crashes of the 20th century, First World War followed by the Great Depression, were harder to grasp because their principal causes were set in motion decades before and largely neglected by mainstream politicians and commentators. Yes, that's with our own crisis. But of course, if you ask anyone left-leaning or protesting, they could for the last 40 years, we could see that there were principal things happening. Just watch any Michael Moore film. If there's one through line with all of his work, starting with Roger and Me, is that there are forces at work that are going to lead to our downfall, that are making people like, say, in Michigan, more vulnerable to everything, whether it be disease or just poverty, all the social ills. And gun violence. So you won the war for Columbine, and that also comes back to American culture, American inequality, you know, so on. Repeatedly frustrated, the aspiration for democracy helped fuel the rise of both left and far-right political movements, pitting them against established ruling elites. The firebrands found their most committed supporters in the exploited populations of then rapidly growing cities, and this is, again, talking about the 19-teens and 20s. Filled mostly with people freshly uprooted from the countryside, sundered from traditional livelihoods and forced to live in urban squalor, the world's great cities had started to become hotbeds of discontent in the late 19th century. The problems of how to accommodate rising aspirations for equality through inequality, generating economies, were particularly acute for nation-states such as Germany, Italy, and Japan that were trying to catch up to the economically advanced Western countries. Once the series of economic shocks that began in the late 19th century climaxed in the Great Depression, the elevation of the far right to power and intensified conflicts between these states was all but guaranteed. But in our own conjuncture, all ingredients for the previous calamity are present, if ominously on an unparalleled scale. For decades now, deindustrialization of the First World, mind you, while the rest of the world has industrialized, the outsourcing of jobs to the Second World, and then automation have deprived many working people of their security and dignity, making the aggrieved and even advanced Western countries vulnerable to demagoguery. At the same time, stalled economic modernization or a botched process of urbanization in a catch-up, like powers in India and Russia, have created in almost textbook fashion the political base for far-right figures and movements. Of course, they're talking about like a neoliberal textbook there. The financial crisis in OA, which has caused deeper and longer damage than the Great Depression did, may have discredited the globalizing elite that promised prosperity to all, creating broad scope, but of course, you had to be middle class to even believe it in the first place. Yet few lessons were learned from that collapse, despite much being written and the Occupy movement basically saying this is wrong. And are we going to learn a lesson from this? We have. I have. This is why the crisis of our time is much more intellectual. And it's interesting. I saw someone who's, I would just describe as kind of just a simple liberal. You know, he's a good guy. And he's starting to, as he's isolated and looking at things, he's actually maybe starting to radicalize. He's starting to ask. He said, like, I'm up in the middle of the night and I'm feeling existential. So I'm asking, he lists a bunch of questions. And I'm like, these are good questions. These are the right questions. These are the questions that lead to being radicalized, to saying the system really sucks and it doesn't actually work at all. Or it works for just the very few. One sign of analytic deficiency, talking about like how, like, you know, so our system is predicated on this, these worldviews, these points of view that are expressed softly with every press conference and the way politicians talk and the technocrats and the philanthropists go about solving problems. But the deficiency of this is that the prescriptions for multiple malaises have remained the same in the mainstream, politics and journalism, you see, because they're all professionals. So deprofessionalizing, I do not necessarily see that as bad. because one of the issues that has caused our situation is the over-professionalization of many sectors, many types of professions. The work of someone who would have a base of knowledge that would go across, say, ecology and economics is now split up between five people. You could see it in city planning, architecture, you know, this, the gardening goes to one person and the building goes to one. You know, in the past, it would be one person who actually designed a cohesive whole. Now it's broken up and those people basically have to coordinate, and thus technology fills and tries to fill in the gaps of the coordination with Slack apps and BIM drawing software, which I'm not going to get into, but it basically allows a drawing, a digital drawing, to be shared between firms much more easily. So it doesn't have to be passed from one set of people to another over a year. It can be worked on simultaneously in 3 months, so it saves a lot of money. So the solutions prescribed by our establishment: more economic reforms, largely in the direction of global free markets, reheated Cold War slogans about the superiority of liberal democracy over quote-unquote authoritarianism, as if our government does not have all of those elements, and aspirations for a return to decency and global leadership, wink, wink, Joe Biden. These hopes for a return to the pre-08 political and ideological status quo are often levied with a heightened, if ineffectual, concern about climate change. Their inadequacy will become clearer in the months to come when afflicted nations, as much as individuals, are tempted to self-isolate, sacrificing many holy cows to the existential urgency of survival. The coronavirus, devastatingly in itself, may prove to be the first of many shocks that lie ahead. So to follow up with the first thing, which kind of said, we hope for this, we hope to address inequity. This one ends with the statement, which I'm kind of trying to get at, which is our establishment is not going to learn anything. They are not going to address equality. They are not going to come at this with new solutions. They are going to come at it with the same solutions. I am seeing it in real time. The solution to our budget deficit because of the lack of spending is to cut health services more, or education, or other things. They don't know who they're going to fire yet. They're just talking about it. They just said, we're going to have to fire somebody. We're $20 million in the hole. Again. The state's saying that. The cities are saying that. Now, of course, all they have to do is tax billionaires. All they have to do is tax millionaires. They don't even have to tax them as people. They could tax the stock transfers. They could tax wealth. All kinds of things. Because in the last decade, see here in New York, we've actually put tax breaks on buying yachts. We actually don't tax the buying of the luxury goods that only millionaires would buy. That's what's so infuriating, seeing Cuomo on TV talk, you know, and he's the hero of the hour. A lot of the problems and the reason why we can't, you know, and then he says like, oh, you know, there's a budget shortfall where, you know, we're going to have to do more of less. Again, this is what cost me my job once upon a time. So maybe in the final bit of this hour, I'll go out of order, and maybe in post, I'll rearrange it. But I wanted to write an excerpt from The Right to be Lazy. This is written by Paul Lafarge. Who is he? He's, to put in context, he is the son-in-law to Karl Marx. So he's the next generation after him, but of course Marx is still alive when this was written, but you know, he's a younger man, Frenchman. So I'm going to read the preface, and then I'm going to skip ahead, because there's a particular passage that I want to get to. So the right to be lazy. So this goes into, I'll go back to degrowth and the need to do less. You know, this is an economy where the entire economy is going to need to be restructured. But the problem is that it's going to restructure in a way that centralizes everything. Centralizes things in the corporate hands. Corporate, non-person, personable hands. Instead, we need to be talking and fighting for, and like this is the platform here, decentralizing, degrowing, small is beautiful, and you know, localizing things. And so what demotivates me and frustrates me right now is that, you know, in order to do that, to even just do some of the stuff on the ground, I need to volunteer my time. This community station, the community gardens, you know, people who have a plot of land, you know, because they have own their house or something, they're all, you know, I'm seeing on Facebook, tons of people building raised beds. It's great. Local food production is going to rise, at least for the people who own their own home. But if you don't, then you need community gardens. And that requires collective labor. It requires coordination, which can be done online. But then eventually we have to do things in person. If not together, but at least we need to be able to access spaces and be able to clean them regularly. And that's the situation with this station right now. And CDC guidelines will be put out, and we'll see how practical they are to follow. And I'm sure they're writing them so that they are practical to follow, because to actually take a better safe than sorry approach would be actually impractical as far as this situation is concerned. But it brings to mind how, like, you know, like I said, in the Como state guidelines, you have to do mass testing. And small businesses can't do that. They're all going to die. They're all going to close. We're not going to have small businesses anymore. This lie that we have small businesses, medium businesses make up the backbone of our economy. I mean, they're not going to be able to handle, the movie theaters can't handle removing half their seats. I mean, could they still make any surplus, any break their margins? And that goes for restaurants. Basically, it's telling restaurants that you have to make, if you follow the guidelines, you're still going to have half of your business, you know, with how badly they're doing now. And that's most of our local economy, actual local businesses owned by people who live in the area. The restaurants, the venues, like everything else is bigger conglomerations, bigger firms, regional firms that are then owned by some capital firm. So what am I getting at? Themes of degrowth. And that means getting the mind virus out of our head that we need to be productive all the time and so on. So it starts here. So this was written in 1883. So that's a year you probably don't hear a lot of literature from. So this is written by the Thars. This is the preface. M. Thiers, at a private session of the Commission on Primary Education in 1849, important year in Europe, I wish to make the influence of the clergy all-powerful, because I count upon it to propagate that good philosophy which teaches man that he is here below to suffer, and not that other philosophy which, on the contrary, bids man to enjoy. M. Thiers was stating the ethics of the capitalist class, whose fierce egoism and narrow intelligence, he repeated. The bourgeoisie, when it was struggling against the nobility sustained by the clergy, hoisted the flag of free thought and atheism. But once triumphant, it changed its tone and manner, and today it uses religion to support its economic and political supremacy. In the 15th and 16th centuries, it had joyfully taken up the pagan tradition and glorified the flesh and its passions, reproved by Christianity. In our days, gorged with goods and with pleasures, it denies the teachings of its thinkers like Rabieres and Detroit, that's a French philosopher, you know, Enlightenment thinkers, and preaches abstinence to the wage workers. Capitalist ethics, a pitiful parody on Christian ethics, strikes with its anathema the flesh of the laborer. Its ideal is to reduce the producer to the smallest number of needs, to suppress his joys and his passions, to condemn him to play the part of a machine turning out work without respite and without thanks. The revolutionary socialists must take up again the battle fought by the philosophers and the pamphleteers of the bourgeois. This is talking about the French Revolution. They must march up to the assault of the ethics and the social theories of capitalism. They must demolish in the heads of the class, which they call to action, the prejudices shown. They must proclaim in the faces of the hypocrites and of all ethical systems that the earth shall cease to be the veil of tears for the laborer, and that in a communist, freer society of the future, which we shall establish peacefully if we may, forcibly if we must, the impulses of men will be given free rein for all the impulses, nature of good. So we're basically saying, this is a reputation of an other pamphlet called The Right to Work, and so on. So, like, again, most good writing is a response to other bad writing. But Right to Work should sound familiar, right? We have entire swaths of legislation which basically destroy unions and basically make it hard, impossible to unionize again. And these are called Right to Work laws. The freedom to work. You see it in the openers. I'm calling the Trump supporters who come out, the conspiracy people who come out to say we need to reopen economy. This isn't really that bad. It's white supremacy in action because it's the freedom to consume and it's the freedom to control others' people because they're not the people that really need to get back to work. It's other people that need to get back to work for them. It's other people that need to work. And that's kind of why the right to be lazy is actually more important, and it's a counter to the right to work, that we need to be working as much as possible. If we worked less for our incomes or required less work, since we actually overproduce in many, many ways, we could actually have enough for everybody and distribute it. So yeah, let's go into the rhetoric here. Blessings of work. This is part two. It's like a four-part, it's like pamphlet-sized. It's not long at all. You could read it, and it is available online. Link will be shared because it is a very old text. But it's long enough that if, like, say, if you can read Harry Potter, you can read this. In 1770 at London, an anonymous pamphlet appeared under the title, An Essay on Trade and Commerce. It made some stir in its time. The author, a great philanthropist, might sound familiar, was indignant that the factory population of England had taken into its head the fixed idea that in their quality of Englishmen, all the individuals composing it have a right of birth and privilege of being freer and more independent than the laborers of any other country in Europa. This idea may have its usefulness for soldiers, since it stimulates their valor, but the less the factory workers are endued with it, the better for themselves and the state. To root out laziness and curb the sentiments of pride and independence, which arise from people being told that they're free, the Essay on Trade proposed to imprison the poor in the ideal workhouses, which should become houses of terror, which they should work 14 hours a day in such fashion that when mealtime was deducted, there should remain 12 hours of work full and complete. 12 hours of work a day. That is the ideal of the philanthropists and moralists of the 18th century. How we have outdone this necessitary plus ultra. Modern factories have become ideal houses of correction, in which the toiling masses are imprisoned, in which they are condemned to compulsory work for 12 to 14 hours, not the men only, but the women and the children. And to think that the sons of the heroes of the terror, French Revolution, have allowed themselves to be degraded by the religion of work to the point of accepting since 1848 as a revolutionary conquest that the law limiting factory work to 12 hours. They proclaim as a revolutionary principle the right to work. Shame to the French proletariat. So this comes from like the side of the left since the New Deal era, which was about like how we guarantee the welfare of people, working people, is to guarantee that they have jobs. So whenever Democrats talk of and this includes our radical Green New Deal and the Green Party, we talk about job creation. But as far as overproduction, the contraction that's occurring, we had too many jobs to begin with. But of course, the rhetoric then is we're creating better jobs that pay better, that give people more value of life, and would necessarily have fewer days a week that you do the job, but for the same amount for an actual living wage that you actually get a living income from working 3 or 4 days a week. But there's been kind of a leftist current that, to secure someone's livelihood is to secure them a job. The ability to work long hours, the ability to have a full-time work schedule. I've had a different set of layabout gamer, I suppose, I have a different set of priorities in my life, which is to enjoy life and not to work, because that's one of the bigger contradictions of capitalism that I learned about in college through a book by the same title, Contradictions of Capitalism. And basically, its thesis was, major contradiction is, there's a Protestant / capitalist work ethic that to work is to be godly, we are put on this world to suffer, so we need to suffer by working hard. Even if the standards have changed from previous centuries, instead of 12-hour workdays, it's 10-hour or 8-hour workdays. But these were things won by labor movements that didn't want to abolish labor, abolish the job itself, but just radically, just to reduce it so that people could actually have a day off. But the other side, the contradiction, of course, is then our entire capitalist economy is based on consumption. You have to spend, that you need to seek out all the entertainments. That if you're not going to the concerts and going out to eat or paying, there is no economy. You know, paying, like, I keep seeing ads. I'm never going to click them. Since I've shifted my kind of media, the way I do things on my phone, I'm getting a lot of ads. And there's a lot of ads given to me on buying meals wholesale, ready-made meals sent to me in the mail. You know, how much of the economy is based on not doing work yourself and pleasures and, you know, and just like have more time for your leisure. At the same time, we must get back to work. We must get back to work. You know, it's like, you know, it's so the line, you know, I wanted to quote was like, it's not hunger that drives people to go outside the factory and beg. And I'm going to replace, like, he used a French industrialist. I'm going to say, like, Mr. Musk, Mr. Gates, Mr. Bezos, it is not hunger that drives me to the warehouse doors. It is my hunger for work. You can see it in the rhetoric that even as people ask, it's like, look, it's not that we don't want to do the work, they say. You know, any kind of picket. It's like, no, we want to do the work. We want to do a good job. We want to work 40, 50 hours a week. We just want to do it without dying. We want to do it without succumbing to this illness. That is the ideology at work. And it's toxic, and we got to fight it. Going to the break, another hour on the horizon for the Three Left Show.
Welcome back
to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, here with a, you know, how do we properly respond to everything that's happening because of the pandemic, the centralization of power in the hands of the 1%. Don't think you don't hear that phrase bandied about much anymore, but I'm going to keep using it. 1% is consolidating power. They're consolidating our grip and infesting everything in our lives, and they will. It's considered an extension of the war on terror, but now instead of invisible terrorists threatening your children, it's the virus. And just like terrorism, it can be anybody. It could be your next door neighbor who has it. It could be people in your workplace. We need to look out for them. We need to keep people isolated. We need to, you know, be safe. Anything for our safety. And for the sake of fighting a pandemic, yes, we should do these draconian things. But it's more in the how do we respond to it? What is our system doing long term that frightens me? Which is to centralize everything. That with all the small businesses cratering, the entire mixed economy of scales is, you know, the only you know, businesses that could be safe to shop at, you know, are going to be the big box stores. The Walmart and the Costco will be the massive, you know, will be the city itself kind of thing, as usually exaggerated. But that will be the place where, you know, things will jack up, things will get worse, and that's where the mob will gather. You know, not outside the places of government, unless it's to say you need to do something about Walmart, but they will be powerless, as they have been. They have always been powerless. The power is in the hands of the 1%, and that's not people in City Hall. It's not even people in the governor's mansion. Cuomo likes to act tough, but he's just kind of the face of it. He's the manager of all us peons for the sake of Wall Street. Otherwise, he would tax them. Otherwise, he is completely incompetent, because that would certainly fill the budget gap. So anyway, this is from a more positive kind of viewpoint. Yes Magazine was relaying an analysis from a group called Waging Nonviolence. I heard them speak in person once. Very optimistic / positive people. Have to be if you go to Wage Nonviolence. Written by Paul Egger. Coronavirus is a historic trigger event, just like the kind of shock that the Bloomberg piece mentioned. Now it is time for a social movement to rise. Now, I think we need much more than a social movement. Get to that later. I think we've had social movements before for the last 40 years. We have had social movements aplenty. They do not seem to have a long-lasting effect. I was part of a social movement. I do not, you know, we can kid ourselves about what kind of effect we had, but as far as policy and changing our structures or system is concerned, I'm not confident we made any impact whatsoever, except in the minds of those that participated. More radicalization is good, but it means, like, okay, what all these people kind of have shifted their consciousness. We're ready to stop working. We're ready to say, like, work is not the purpose of our lives. Or I deserve to be able to have an income and live without having to work 50-hour weeks, 40-hour weeks, whatever it is. To hold 3 jobs, even if they're all part-time. We can build a powerful people's response to provide care in our communities and reshape the limits of what is politically possible. But here's the take from Waging Nonviolence. So I'll just read it through. There are times in history when sudden events, natural disasters, economic collapses, pandemics, wars, famines, they change everything. They change politics. They change the economics. They change public opinion in drastic ways. Many social movement analysts call these trigger events. During a trigger event, things that were previously unimaginable quickly become reality. After all, everything is impossible until it isn't. As the social and political map is then remade. On the one hand, major triggers are rare, but on the other, seen them regularly in recent decades. Events such as 9/11, the Iraq War, I wouldn't call that a trigger event though, maybe in the Middle East, Hurricane Katrina, and the financial crash of 2008 have all had major repercussions on national life, leading to political changes that would have been difficult to predict beforehand. COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic, is by far the biggest trigger event of our generation. It is a combination of natural disaster, economic collapse happening at the same time. Topping it off, this public health crisis is coming right in the middle of one of the most consequential political seasons of our lifetime. Now, I disagree with that kind of sentiment because there are types like that say that every election is the most important election. Every election in my lifetime, ever since I gained the right to vote by turning 18, I've been told that every election I was participating in was the most important election. 08 was the most important. 2012 was the most important. And of course, the last one was the most important. You know, I'm sure the one in 92 was the most important. Everyone, all of them are most important. I'm tired of hearing that. It's just played out. Say something else. Trigger events can create confusion and unease, but they also present tremendous opportunity for people who have a plan and know how to use the moment to push forward their agendas. These agendas can be reactionary, as when conservatives and fascists pass harsh austerity measures and spread xenophobia, the type of activity documented in Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine. Yet this type of response needed not prevail, with a counter-agenda rooted in a commitment to democracy, a deep sense of collective empathy. Communities can flourish even amid a crisis, maybe because of a crisis. In fact, we can find many examples in history of how progressive and solidaric impulses have come to the fore in response to trigger events. The New Deal's emergence as a response to the Great Depression of the 1930s is one example. More recent is Occupy Sandy's mobilization in New York City. You know, more recent, but you know, almost a decade ago. In 2012, Rebecca Solon's 909 book, A Paradise Built in Hell, contains myriad more examples of humane collective efforts that responded to disaster. Now, that leads me to, it's more concern than critique. Do not take it as critique or, you know, naysaying. But when I look at all of the mutual aid action being taken, it's all good. But what I'm also seeing is it's still dependent on our capitalist infrastructure. You know, unless all the food being given out is grown in community gardens, I'm not seeing it as part of an alternative. I'm not seeing it as, well, it's an alternative way of being and acting as opposed to hoarding and whatnot and being reactionary. So there's that. But as far as being like in the big scale, my thinking, the alternative to our capitalist system and the centralizing forces to decentralize, it needs to be ours. And that's something they need to be prepared for in the last 10 years. But we can also spend the next 10 years building something that's decentralized. It's what we need to be building. You know, I'm looking into learning about how to do more investigative journalism in my position here doing this show, because news gathering is totally centralized. And although we can say that, you know, we have unprofessional, I mean that not as a value judgment, deprofessionalized democratic news gathering in the form of people, you know, shooting things on their phones and taking pictures and sharing and blogging and journaling, observations. And this is a type of, you know, creating one's picture of the world. They're not organized reports with a purpose. Why investigative journalism in reporting that's decentralized and not through one big, you know, Hearst newspaper is needed. Today, we face the prospect that hundreds of thousands of people in the United States, millions may die. The only way we can prevent some of the worst tragedy is such a response. In my writing on social movements, I've argued that triggers create liminal spaces that mass protest movements can use to mobilize the forces of grassroots democracy. I like that. Occupy was like that. In the wake of such an event, organizers often find themselves in a moment of the whirlwind, in which the standard rules of how politics work are turned on their head. Many of the great social movements of the past have been born out of these moments. But these moments require skillful navigation, the ability to use prophetic promotion, to spread a humane vision, and the faith that mass mobilization can open new avenues to change that, at the outset, seem distant and improbable. Occupy was like that, very much so. And again, a moment, not really a movement, because it didn't really last more than a year. At least in the form that was having an impact. There was an attempt to build organizations out of it, but a lot of them were then co-opted by the Democratic Party or the nonprofit establishment. Same with Black Lives Matter. They eventually, since they're not independent enough, or they're not minded that we're not going to work with Democrats at all, We're not going to work with the status quo at all. I should rephrase that. You know, we're not going to say try to work on the inside or influence those already in power. That means you're playing their game and you eventually assimilate. Even the Sanders movement then has become that, because second time around, second campaign, the word is that the Sanders campaign hired a bunch of insiders, establishment types. And thus their campaign was more tame, less mention of socialism, still New Deal politics, but, you know, it's, the fire was less there. And they weren't going to attack Biden. Social movements are the vehicle for mass participation because, you know, we need to actually take part. Right now, lots of people are formalizing action plans and policy demands, focusing on how the government should respond or measures that elected officials might pass by way of emergency response. These include plans by usual cast, Bernie Sanders, Warren, AOC's call for emergency UBI, proposals by groups by Working Families Party, National Nurses United, collection of grassroots organizers. What's missing is a platform and vision for mass participation, a means through which, so these are platforms put out by, you know, these so-called leaders. I consider them more misleaders, you know, socialist faces in high places, just look down and don't really mobilize. They don't create a platform for mass participation. So this one kind of mentions that you need that too. A means through which people can join in and collectively take part in a movement to create the type of just response to society needs. Organizations. A movement can support, amplify, and fill in gaps left by government and the healthcare infrastructure. So these are organizations, and, you know, mutual aid societies is what he's talking about. Obviously, social distancing and isolation require to slow the spread of the pandemic present unique challenges. For one thing, people are limited in their ability to physically come together. Meanwhile, many of the traditional tools and tactics of social movements cannot be deployed under these circumstances. This is what's driving me a little nuts right now. Thinking about, like, how, you know, and that's where, like, my only hope is then we do have some type of normalcy, so at least we can take what we're learning and thinking about as we, you know, many have self-reflected and starting to see things in a new light to put them in practice. But how do we do that? This should not, however, blind us to the things that can be done for mutual support in local areas and so on. You know, it's like, so an example of where, like, I see mutual aid societies, like, seeing big piles of bottled water, you know, packaged food, stuff from, you know, centralized industries that are produced centrally, and then it's being distributed via this community action, which is one part of the equation. The other part that's then missing is then the local and decentralized production of the stuff. So instead of, say, buying and distributing bottled water, we should be buying rain catchers and distributing those to people and showing them how to set it up or setting it up for them and just saying, here's your cistern. Now you can, you know, it's not going to go right into your plumbing, but neither is bottled water. It's not convenient, but it's actually renewable. Every time it rains, it will fill up a bit and we don't have to use all that plastic. Major structure-based organizations have infrastructure and resources that seem as if that would make them natural candidates for rallying the wider public. However, they also face institutional limitations that prevent them from scaling their efforts to meet the enormity. So this is talking about more mainstream/established groups. Like labor unions are commonly preoccupied with responding to how the crisis affects their own membership, making them essential hubs for action for people within their structure, but leaving them with a little capacity to engage people outside of their ranks, or to absorb the energy of others who might want to get involved. This is where a decentralized organization like the IWW and others, where it really is kind of more inclusive, you know, a Green Party chapter can occur with any group of concerned citizens and then get, you know, some educational support from higher up. Meanwhile, you know, the veteran activists like myself. Meanwhile, politicians and leading advocacy organizations are often focused on the details of the inside game, carefully monitoring and attempting to use insider leverage to influence the policies that are being debated. This is an important role, but it does not address the vacuum that exists in terms of mobilizing large numbers. Therefore, it is often scrappy, decentralized, and sometimes ad hoc groups that play vital roles in shaping a social movement's response, which more institutionalized organizations can get behind once underway. You know, they jump on following the actual, you know, ad hoc groups. Now, the thing about ad hoc groups, though, is that they form quickly and they also disperse quickly. Occupy didn't last because there was an email list. There were a core group of activists, but it didn't feel like an organization with staying power. Like here in Albany, we actually rented a space. We were as close to some established activist group as you could get, but we still had this monthly attrition that was occurring. And we discussed and tried all different ways of trying to curb it, you know, throwing parties, doing social things, not just being all business and the cause. Nothing seemed to work. You know, what was the problem? Well, not to sound like a conservative, it's not they don't own this talking point, but you need skin in the game. And I see a future of left unity and let's say this actual community support in the form of paying dues. And the point of, like, you know, we can't really have an alternative to our neoliberal, our conservative, or wherever you live, you know, city or local government, unless you form your own. And you can't really form your own unless you have a group that's collecting some sort of tax base, or at least has a budget that is supported regularly. So it's not based on, you know, fundraising drives and donations or the generosity, wink, wink, of some large donor. That many of these grassroots organizations apparently seem to rely on. Well, there's other ways that people have responded before. It goes on. Say there's a picture of like a big pile of bottled water. This is, you know, hurricane relief. But of course, there's, you know, always a need for stopgaps like this, but it still seems like a dependence on, you know, plastic and bottled water industry, which is basically just the big food industry, big agro. They have the power at the end of the day, profit makers. So how to make it happen? If we know what we need is a mass social movement response, how do we make this happen, especially in times of social distancing? There are some suggestions. I'm not too hot on them, but let's talk about them. Millions of people are stuck in their homes, unable to go to work, but they can still pursue action on two tracks, one focused on mutual aid and the other building political pressure around a platform. So I basically already talked about this. So there's the mutual aid stuff. Please take part in that. Look for it. And the other is, you know, there are platforms like the general strike and the rent strike. And, you know, there's these platforms of like UBI and emergency UBI, let's say. $2,000 a month is what's required. But, you know, it's focused on the lobbying and social media swarming, which it's something, but it's not really the power that lasts. It's quick mobilization stuff. Organizers should be looking to create means for local groups to share information and best practices. They should encourage common vision and messaging. A lot of good organizations meet here, especially for, like, this is the lighter, if you're just kind of getting into or thinking about movement building. Now, this is all old stuff for me because I've read stuff like this for the last decade over and over and over again. So it all kind of feels samey to me. So I'm less interested. Oh, yeah. And then it ends with kind of like a Sanders campaign should pivot to becoming the movement focused on pandemic response. So this is a little dated already, even after a month. Sanders' campaign has built one of the largest and most sophisticated grassroots organizing campaigns in American history. They have tens of thousands of volunteers who know how to run phone banks and talk to their neighbors. They also have more than 1 million donors who are willing to contribute funds to help support a people's movement advancing justice and democracy. Especially since, like, a lot of has been pushed to make reoccurring donations. That's what dues are, reoccurring donation. Just $10. Cup of coffee. If Sanders decides to transform his campaign from political presidential to one against the pandemic and its impacts, a drive with massive infrastructure would emerge overnight. Right. Sure. Anyway, so there's Paul Egler is the director of the Center for the Working Poor in LA, and a movement director for the Henry Institute, and co-author of This Is an Uprising with his, I guess, sibling, Mark Enger. from Waging Nonviolence, which is a kind of an organizing group of its own, or rather an educational one. They talk about all the ways of doing civil disobedience and the ways of activism that is nonviolent, nonviolent, of course. One story shared was how they would influence people at a military base. They would just sine wave continuously. It would be like one person or so. And they would sine wave daily, like all the time. And it's just a simple anecdote, but like, you know, one of the truck drivers brings supplies and he eventually quit because the sign would say, like, you know, don't support the war. Something like that. Something simple. Simple is best. And in seeing it enough times, it gets in their heads. It's like, you know what, I am supporting something wrong. But you got to be reminded of it all the time. It takes a lot of different interactions, especially if it's the same interaction every time. But like an advertisement, it just gets in your head. And that's kind of what I seek to be. You know, listen regularly to the Three Left Show. Eventually, you'll dream. You'll have a dream where you hear my voice say something random. That's the ultimate goal. Happens to me. So to continue on that line, now the more militant side. So I was Waging Nonviolence with the kind of mamby-pamby social movement can change the world. We all just have to work together, lobby, call your congressman kind of stuff. Here's the more militant side from BeFreedom, BeFreedom.co. From strike wave to general strike. That's right. So I wanted to link to It's Going Down. They would likely have reports with the full numbers of the impact and the amount who participated in the general strike on May 1st, May Day. Happy May Day, everybody, even though it was last week. Let's see. This is also shared / published by Counterpunch and Popular Resistance. The strike wave is here. The strike wave is real. Can workers take the next steps toward a general strike? The current crisis is, and that's what real frickin' power is. The current crisis is a rare opportunity for us to build a movement both outside of electoral politics and based on an organizing model. That happens because the biggest shortcoming of the left and the social movements is our lack of organizing. Mm-hmm. Organizing can do what good intentions or radical theory or electoral campaigns cannot, turn solidarity from a dream into a living thing. But without some serious solidarity, all our hopes for a general strike will fail to materialize. By general strike, also proxy of actually having political power ourselves? Maybe. As we build the solidarity infrastructure needed for a general strike, let's not lie to each other. It's called class struggle for a reason. Strikes were painful, with workers pitting their sacrifice and suffering up against the boss's profits. Strikes are no party. But general strikes, while rare, are a good match for the unprecedented interlocking crises we face. There is an answer to our problem. It's the age-old working class answer, solidarity forever. But never forget that solidarity is forged in sacrifice, too. Solidarity is not simply passing a resolution or staking a claim. It is an action like a boycott or mutual aid effort, or sending money to those at the front lines, or going on strike yourself. The strike is back, baby. After a long period of retreat, the strike has returned with a vengeance. In 2018, West Virginia strikers kicked off a strike wave, the likes of which we have not seen in decades. And like today's strikes, the leadership is coming from the rank and file, not the union officials. Supplied is a graph that, it's a simple bar graph that just shows the number of workers involved in strikes. In the last year, it looks like the last year on this graph is 2017, so let's just say that's when it started, and maybe you can assume it's going up. But the last time striking, the number of workers involved in strikes were this high, it was 1998. It's been a whole 20 years. And that low from 1998 was, from the graph here, it was basically a flat line back to 1980, right, when Reagan came to office and started breaking strikes. So the number of strikes, the number of workers involved in strikes, dramatically lowered to a level that has only now started been matched. So we're back to 1980 levels, and maybe in the next decade we can go back to 1960 levels, which is where you literally had three million. 3 million was the number back then. So it also should be proportional to the growth of our population. So we should be going for 10 million. That's what it would take. That 3% of the population, once 3% basically say, I'm going to take the day off, I'm going to call in sick, unless you pass this, That's where the establishment will really start to sweat. Because otherwise, they're laughing at us. We should feel ridiculous and embarrassed at our disempowerment. Because that's what all this centralizing does. It disempowers us. It really removes all of our agency. And I hate it. I hate the thought of it. Okay, in this moment of pandemic, panic strikes and unrest are focused on immediate demands. We want a general strike, and that is a great thing, but we have to pave the way between the largely defensive strikes that exist right now and the political offensive that is the heart of what a general strike would be. Meaning like an actual taking of power, that's what the general strike is for. Otherwise, the strikes happening now are defensive. They're, we want masks. We want our workplace cleaned. We want to not die. That's the defensive strike. You know, like I said, they're using the rhetoric of, we just want to go back to work. We want to work the long hours and earn our maybe subpar wages or maybe their living wages, depending on the situation. But there's still this, like, look, I don't want to work less. I still have a family to raise, right? Because that's accepted that you need a certain income to live. And that's something that we need to question. That's one of those big questions that radicalizes you to think about, like, well, why do you need this big income when there's all this wealth that seems to be collected already? We could distribute it and none of us would need to actually do any labor if we just distributed surplus. You know, we could probably go like 5 years without actually working unless you're actually in services. But then we could work so little that, you know, it would just be a few days a week. Or if we want to engage people, we have to listen carefully to what they say and do. The strongest currents of resistance that I see, the actions, demands, and tactics around the immediate life and death questions of safety, protection, and survival. So this includes, and this is, I just listed a lot of these, increased wages for essential workers, the conversion of production to ventilators, masks and tests, universal health care, of course, the New York Health, plug in there, New York Health, no rent, no evictions, no vacancies, mutual aid to serve people, strikes, slowdowns, and rolling job actions, or staying home, let the workers decide. These may be immediate demands, but in them we can imagine the possibilities of a general strike and what those demands of that would be. In these demands, and in the bosses' rush to get us back to work, we can see that labor creates all the wealth. We can see that workers are essential and bosses are disposable. When workers demand that they switch production to ventilators or masks, the seeds of worker control are taking root, as I suggested in a previous episode. Housing and healthcare are revealed as demands of direct interest to everyone, not just a moral stand. If the general strike is the front line, mutual aid is the quartermaster providing aid and comfort to the troops. Mutual aid shows us what a democratic economy looks like. Taken together, these actions and demands are the beginnings of a struggle for economic, workplace, and community democracy. You can call it freedom and democracy, or you can call it socialism and revolution. Call it reason or call it treason. I don't care what you call it. Solidarity is not simply good intentions or fine speeches that politicians sometimes make. Solidarity grows by acting on the principle that your liberation is bound up with mine. With solidarity, a new world is possible. Without it, we surrender to corporate power. By all means, have your steering committee pass a resolution. But real solidarity can only be achieved by organizing and activism. Here are some possibilities. We need to coordinate strategic boycotts targeting Amazon, Whole Foods, and other corporate criminals. This was done on May Day. We need a huge email list and a website updated daily to suggest targets to coordinate timing. Who will take up this work? I would like a independent left-wing party to do that. You have the organizations like General Strike, which are a collection of leftists, which aren't really like, say, a working party yet, but they are the kind of infrastructural organization to coordinate these things that I am on board with. Crisis cannot be resolved by normal means. When compared with the narrow vision of the electoral arena, even these initial spontaneous uprisings are full of ideas for redistributing wealth and power. Even in the depths of the crisis, unanimous congressional action could deliver nothing greater than temporary cash payments so meager as to exaggerate the very wealth inequality that made our world unsustainable in the first place. These tasty crumbs are welcomed aid to workers, but were also a good move by the ruling class to calm things down. Without real resistance, our rulers got away with tossing us the bare minimum necessary to engineer consent so they could gain a far bigger prize, the further consolidation of 40 years of corporate power. It's not that progressive Democrats produce nothing. They move the discourse in important ways. But the unanimous consent to the corporate bailout signals the limits of even well-meaning electoral activity under existing conditions. Now, again, this point of view sees any kind of electoral activity as working in the Democratic Party, the line that pretty much any political professor, even a left-leaning one, left-wing one, will say, no, third parties aren't the way. We can only take over the Democrats, as if that's ever been accomplished, as ever that's ever been possible. It's not. I don't know why they say that. They just seem connected to this. I mean, you literally just saw a really large, concentrated, really robust effort to take over the Democratic Party, or at least take a share of it, to at least have a voice in it. It all crashed and burned. And that's how I'm going to see it. You can disagree. It's fine. You know, you tried your hardest. It's a really good effort. But it's like I kind of took the position years ago that was not a non-starter. I mean, you do a lot of good things in the process of doing the we're going to take over the Democratic Party, right? You organize people or you get your email list built up for the next thing. But that next thing needs to be something that's not looking to engage with the establishment at all. There are opponents. We need to fight them. Not fighting them in their ring, in their terms, with their people. The left needs, let's see, here's a quote from Ella Baker. You didn't see me on television. You didn't see news stories about me. The kind of role that I tried to play was to pick up pieces and put together pieces out of which I hoped organization might come. My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders. This is from the Civil Rights Movement. The left needs Ella Baker's vision. Do we have the capacity to pick up the pieces or put pieces together? What will help the millions move? What will build the capacity for self-organization? We need to learn and quick, because it is when millions move, then and only then, that we will unleash the enormous creative energies of the people. They will find the way forward. The people are telling us where to find them. Can we catch up? It's due time for all organizers to engage, listen, and learn, to stand with our new leaders. There's no greater solidarity than this. I like being this media voice. I like standing beside people. I do not feel comfortable being the cis white male, et cetera, that I am, to be the leader of anything. I don't really like taking up that role, mostly because of my introvertedness and whatever qualities I have. But it's also like, at the end of the day, it's really not my fight. It's a fight that I want to have, and it's a vision that I want to do, but it's really like I'm not the plaintiff here. You know, I'm not the one with the jackboot on my face. I want to help get the boot off of other people. Let's see. One last thing I wanted to cover about that, left-wing organizing and such, is I just actually filed to pay dues to the IWW and be a full member, get that red card. Am I an organizer in IWW? No. Do I have a stake in IWW? Well, now I do financially. But I mean, am I in a IWW union? So first, let me back up. Don't want to overexplain, but IWW is a decentralized union. It's not dependent on any particular workplace, type of work, whatever. It's usually kind of small scale, small is beautiful. Let's organize people, 10 people at a time. You can be a member without needing to organize your workplace even. That's the tack I'm taking. I don't plan on organizing my workplace. My workplace is actually quite humane, more humane than probably anywhere else in town. But what I see in a possible left unity and kind of us coming together is we kind of need skin each other's game. A common complaint in activist circles is, why should I do things with them? They're not doing things with us. Someone's got to do the opposite. Start paying dues into their organization with no expectation of anything in return. I'm going to pay dues to IWW because I want them to have the budget to organize more workplaces in my town, in my area. I want them to be able to do more or to be able to have the resources to, when they brainstorm ideas for actions and things, that they have the money to do them and they don't have to put things down, which is a position I've been put in many a meeting that goes nowhere, that where no decisions are made. No action is taken, or we just kind of muddle and like, we want to do something, but we really don't know what we can do. it's a feeling of disempowerment that occurs to me over and over and over again. It's usually because of lack of budget. When you do, you can say, yes, we can give money to support this. We can donate to the Mutual Aid Network. You know, I don't have the time. I'm already doing my projects. So let's financially support each other. Pay dues. And I see it in action with the Howie Hawkins campaign. He is, you know, and this is something that there's some Green Party member that complain about this. He is a member of both the Green Party and the Socialist Party of America, USOSP. This has allowed him to be endorsed by two different niche left-wing parties. And now he has announced his VP candidate, which is an Angela Walker. She ran for sheriff in Michigan, and she is an SP member. Only an SP member. But now it is actually a joint ticket with two left-wing parties. This is something I've never seen before. And Hawkins was also trying to get basically the endorsement of the Socialist Workers Party. You know, all these little tiny little boutique places. You know, there's the Socialist Alternative too. You know, if we could get them, all of us, you know, we could definitely break 1% easy, and then we can build and get to 5. We'd be strengthening our volunteer base fivefold, you know, by having one candidate, one platform that we're all on board with. That's platformism, or at least one type of it. Sometimes in my head, platformism is joining other people's platforms or like working within organizations and not having your own. I'm very much for having your own, as I am in the Green Party, and that's my organization. But if I want others to work with the Greens and not be splitters or say like, oh, the DSA, you know, I need to be, I and others, we need to be members of all of these organizations, even nominally. We could at least start with that, to allow people to be nominal members. Usually this is in the form of just being on their email list. So at least you can, like, when they do something, you at least have the possibility of showing up. To say like, oh, I'm not going to show up for their rally. They didn't show up to my rally. Well, I try to do that. And if I can't do that, since we're not really doing the rally thing anymore and the usual go-nowhere activism, we can at least support each other with money. Or at least I can, because my income hasn't gone anywhere. Now I got a stimulus check, which I wasn't expecting, but I filed taxes, so I get it. And now I've got an extra $1,000 in my bank account. And I'm basically going to put it into a bunch of campaigns and stuff. That's how I'm spending it. Because, well, I'm also paying off my student debt. And in a year, my student debt's going to be gone. So there's that. And I'm going to have even more, you know, access funds of sorts. Because my expenses are just tiny. Yeah, this one's really short. Okay. From EcoWatch back to EcoWatch. Don't worry, I'll edit this around. A group of biodiversity experts warn that future pandemics are on the horizon if mankind does not stop its rapid destruction of nature. And this is where the green energy, industrial green energy debate is. You know, if it's decentralized, if the creation of renewable energy is decentralized, then there is more possibilities of it being sustainable. But as long as it's centralized, where the mining of rare earth minerals and metals need to be used to make the solar panels, and the solar panels are made in one factory and then they have to be shipped across the world, that is centralized and unsustainable. It creates actually more destruction of nature, or at least a similar amount, but maybe with a little less air pollution. The writing and article published Monday by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. Wow, it's a mouthful. The authors put the responsibility for COVID-19 squarely on our shoulders. Quoting, "There is a single species that is responsible for the pandemic, us. As with the climate and biodiversity crises, recent pandemics are a direct consequence of human activity, particularly our global financial and economic system, based on a limited paradigm that prizes economic growth at any cost. We have a small window of opportunity in overcoming the challenges of current crises to avoid sowing the seeds of future ones," the authors of this wrote. So here's where these scientists are. I'm backing them. I'm standing them, because they're seeing that this is a bigger structural problem, and they're ready to get political about it. Or at least they're taking a political stance by saying, paradigm shift that prizes economic growth needs to change. All right, not just saying things are going to change, and they're going to change big. And I just hope we address inequality along the way. The authors of the report include the three co-chairs of a comprehensive 2019 global assessment report. This is on biodiversity and ecosystems. which found that 1 million species of plant and animals are at risk of extinction within decades. This is a major mass extinction event, the likes of which we've not seen in 30,000 years, I guess. Which found that 1 million species of plants and animals, let's see, the fourth author, Peter Danzig, as the president of EcoHealth Alliance, and is tasked with spearheading their global assessment, as The Guardian reports. Authors argue that government stimulus plans need to include sustainable and nature-positive initiatives. Nature-positive. It may be potentially expedient at this time to relax environmental standards in the prop of industries such as intensive agriculture, long-distance transport, such as airlines, fossil fuel-dependent energy sectors, but doing so without requiring urgent and fundamental change essentially subsidizes the emergence of future pandemics. We're just repeating the same cycle, and thus we'll need a permanent state of pandemic response, as the first article I read kind of outlined, that we're always going to be, you know, all our education has to be virtualized. Everything is going to be computerized. Zoom meetings will be the new normal, the new normal. But the new normal is still leading to mass extinction. So that there's that big, yeah. It's not just about our own little individual freedoms, which are still important. But then there's the rest of life on Earth. Get into the black pill stuff. They also fault Walton Greed as allowing microbes that lead to novel diseases to jump from animals to humans. Rampant deforestation, uncontrolled expansion of agriculture, intensive farming, mining, and infrastructure development, as well as the exploitation of wild species, have created a perfect storm for the spillover of diseases from wildlife to people. You know, comes from bats, but also the Patagonia. They warn that 1.7 million unidentified viruses known to infect people are estimated to exist in mammals and water birds. Any one of these may be more disruptive and lethal than COVID-19. The programs we're talking about will cost tens of billions of dollars a year. Pocket change. But if you get one pandemic, even just one a century, that costs trillions. So you still come out with incredibly good return on investment. And I gotta make that financial argument. Business as usual will not work. Business as usual right now for pandemics is waiting for them to emerge and hoping for a vaccine. That's not a good strategy. We need to deal with the underlying drivers. Their assessment has been supported recently by others in the scientific community. A study published earlier this month blamed human impact on wildlife for the current outbreak, as The Guardian reported. The authors of a new article end their piece on an optimistic note for nature's resiliency. Quoting, "We can build back better and emerge from the current crisis stronger and more resilient than ever. But to do so means choosing policies and actions that protect nature so that nature can help protect us." Nice. What kind of policies would those be? Degrowth. But that is just one of those policies. It's a bigger, it's the shift that I feel is more necessary to think about less work, less wasteful production. Otherwise, I'm going to skip to my outro. So nearing the end of the show, my profound thanks for listening. An important skill as important as talking. I have a bad habit of interrupting people now, or I always have, really. Comes from being ignored as a child, and institutionally speaking, not in my family life, but at school, let's say. Because I could get straight A's, but it actually meant I needed less help, which meant less attention to me. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, ideas for the show, or stories, or topics you'd like to hear discussed. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe the work that of mine is worth paying a living wage. But you can be helped by supporting the show via my Patreon page, Three Life Show. You can also support with your time by telling others you might believe would be interested in listening, liking, and sharing our Facebook and Twitter posts and pages. Sometimes I share some memes. Mostly I'm posting when I do episodes and the live stream here. And hopefully I will actually get around to editing it via video. My computer is finally in good condition. And I'm ready to start learning proper video editing. Yes, all of these social media stuff can be found by searching for The Three Left Show on any of those platforms. The last 10 episodes are broadcast on all or most podcasting apps. And a full archive, though, of shows and show notes and info about myself are found at threelefts.news. Nothing else. Of course, the most important thing is to put these ideas and thinking and projects talked about here in practice for yourself. Thanks. Until next time, keep waving the flags of the three lefts.